war against a man we've never met.
He stayed with Morn 2 more days, then moved on through the grassy plains.
Hawks soared on the warm air. At last, among the patchy pines below Dolandon, he found the last clan he'd come to see.
High Priest of Narashtavik,
Hop grinned.
You do understand that among the clan of the Broken Herons you're still nothing more than a lowly cub.
The lowliest, Dante said.
Have any pants that need scrubbing?
Yes, but I'll have to save a few for Blaze to do. He must remember his place as well.
Where is he?
On a trip of his own.
Is it an interesting one?
I can't say.
Ah.
Hop narrowed his eyes.
Is everything good?
Fine, Dante said.
How are you?
How are my clan brothers and sisters?
Hop waited another moment before explaining they'd lost many warriors, but in the weeks since the king had renounced his claim to their lands, the men and women of the Herons had set about replacing those losses with impressive vigor.
Dante nodded when he should nod, laughed when he should laugh.
But Hop watched him too closely.
I ask again, is everything good?
It is, Dante said. I'm just tired. This is the first time I've been able to slow down in months.
A warm breeze carried the smell of pollen and pines. The sun was sinking, its gauzy rays piercing the shield of needles. Crickets chirped and whirred.
Well, it's too early for sleep, Hop declared. How about we pass the time with a story?
All right.
Good. This is the story of Davran. Do you know the story of Davran?
Good.
Davran was a Norn who lived long ago.
Hundreds of years.
He lived in a small town on one of the small rivulets that led into the great river. When he was young, he was kindly. Adults adored him. Many young women did too. But the only woman he could see was a girl named Yorin. Yorin was beautiful. Have you seen the glaciers in the mountains, the water they feed to the lakes? Yorin's eyes were as green and vivid as the water of the glaciers. She could fight, too, with sword and bow. Her nulla was in the weaving of rope and the tying of knots. Unusual, but so was she. Do you know how much you can do with a good knot? Even a bad one can hold something fast for the present, or confuse the most cunning of men. And Yorin tied Davran into knots, too. With his tongue so knotted, he couldn't speak to her. Every time he saw her, and couldn't speak, that pulled the knot in his heart that much tighter. Davran's nulla was wooden carvings, small ones, itty-bitty models of people and animals and places. To say to Yorin what his knotted tongue couldn't, Davran set to carving. He carved tiny pines and tiny deer. He gouged a stream bed out of a plank, and when he smeared the stream's tiny banks with bear fat, it could even carry water. From bits of wood as small as a pea, he carved birds and perched them in the pines. He carved himself, happy and hale and adoring. And lastly, he carved her. On the final piece he spent weeks of patient labor, shaving away the splinters with a razor until he captured each curve of her cheek and muscle of her arms. The carving was beautiful, stunning. So real that when Davran looked at it, he fell in love with it just as he had with Yorin. All this time, Davran had lived in retreat, in a shack in the woods. When his little world was finished, he returned to the larger world and discovered Yorin had married. He went back to the shack. He smashed the world he'd spent months creating. He lit a fire and smiled as the statue of Yorin burned. Hop paused to smile and drink from a wineskin, which Dante gratefully accepted. It tasted like pears, and was strong enough to sting his eyes.
Once his little Yorin had burnt down to cinders, Davron raged and wept and pounded the trees with his fists. He carried his anger for years, longer than he'd even known Yorin. In time, he cooled, just like all fires do. He began to create again, carving little trees, little birds, little people. He carved and carved and carved. Locked away in his shack, he built whole worlds to keep him company. Then again he had all the time in the world, because in the depths of his anguish he'd vowed never to see another person again, believing they were good for nothing but pain. And he stuck to that vow, and he carved and carved and carved. He built new shacks to host his world. If you'd seen it, you would have clapped and cried. Yes, even you. They were that wonderful. If you looked at them from the corner of your eye, you'd swear the little wooden birds were chirping, the young girls were laughing. As we all do, one day Davron died. Hop stopped. Dante looked up. Then what? Then nothing. Because he didn't know anyone. He died. And because there was no one to see them, his little worlds died with him. Dante frowned. Then how do you know about it? Because Joson Joe saw. How do you think? What I think is that this is one of those stories with a moral. Are you trying to teach me something? If I were, do you think I'm stupid enough to think you'd listen? I don't know. We can all be pretty dumb sometimes. They were silent for a time. Shadows dappled their arms as they drank from the wineskin. Hop pointed to the dragonflies wheeling above the cattails at the edge of the pond the clan had camped beside. See the dragonflies? The way the light glistens on their wings? Aren't they beautiful? Dante looked. They weren't. They were as scaly as dead lizards. Their eyes bulged, their mouths clutched at lesser flies, shredding, grinding, casting away their prey's wings and stick-like legs. They were hideous, monsters of nightmares. "Blazer's gone," he blurted. Hop's face fell. "Dead." Dante shook his head. His eyes blurred. "I killed Lyra. I didn't want to, but I had to. They would have married someday. I killed my brother's wife, and now my brother is gone." Dragonflies gleamed and soared. Fish broke the surface of the pond and disappeared without a trace. The sun sank lower every minute, flagging, drawn helplessly to the parted jaws of two hazy mountain peaks. Its failing light did nothing to drive away the ghosts. He knew they would always be with him. The Black Star, The Cycle of Aron, Book 3. Chapter 1. Blaze took a final look at the field, memorizing what he was about to lose, and disappeared beneath the roaring tsunami of rock. Dust rushed past the avalanche in a choking cloud, sweeping away the sunlight. The earth shook and groaned as if the tide of stones would never end. At last it did, and the dust settled, and Blaze was gone. The dream was always the same, but that didn't mean Dante was used to it. He woke with a gasp. The mountain air was cold, but his chest was slick with sweat. The smell of pines sat on the damp air. Lou, the young monk Ollivander had insisted Dante bring with him, slept on, tangled in his blankets. Dante got up for a walk. Dawn was an hour away, but he knew he wouldn't be able to get back to sleep. He was so sick of the guilt. During daylight hours it was easy enough to ignore it, to pretend it wasn't there. But when he slept, when his mind set down its shield and doused the fire of consciousness. The dreams crawled in. Something rustled in the fallen leaves. Dante went still. The noise was soft, deliberate. The whisper of a predator watching from the brush. Small, though, perhaps a lynx. Dante considered illuminating it with the nether, then walked on. The woods smelled of sap and cold dew on lichen. He pulled his cloak tighter around his shoulders. Though the Woden Mountains began hardly 100 miles east of Narashtivik, he'd never been so deep within them, and he spent what was left of the night wandering in a wide circle around the camp. Getting a feel for the steepness of the slopes, the firmness of the ground, which he touched not only with his feet, but with the nether, exploring the shadowy net dispersed in the old death lurking in the soil. Once, he crouched and touched the chilly ground. The nether rose in a black puddle that absorbed the silver of the moon. It looked the same as it did anywhere else. First light touched the woods, grey-blue and eerie. He returned to camp. Dawn was as slow to struggle past the eastern peaks as Lou was to fight his way from his bedroll. The monk was barely of man's age, and though he was talented with the nether, his superiors believed he lacked ambition. That was why he, in particular, had been assigned to attend Dante. The trip was nothing much, a visit to a quiet backwater that probably wouldn't have noticed if Narashtivik had annexed it, but the location was a touch exotic, and the travel had its arduous moments. With luck, it would stir Lou's imagination, show him the opportunities available to those who worked hard and focused on making the most of themselves. Or so his minders believed. Dante nudged his sleeping carcass with a damp toe. Lou started, thrashing about in his blankets. His eyes were round and wide in the dawn. Seeing Dante, he donned the vaguely intoxicated smile of someone attempting to mask their confusion with agreeability. "You were out," he said. "We're in the middle of nowhere," Dante said. "That makes everywhere out." "But what about the Kappers?" "Terrifying to imagine, I'm sure. Have you ever seen a Kappa?" "No," Lou said slowly. "But I never saw you until I did, either." Dante rolled his eyes. "Unlike Kappers, I wasn't hunted to extinction 500 years ago. Get moving. Long hike ahead of us." Lou emerged from his bedding and dressed. While he prepared for the day, Dante boiled black tea, which they drank with a breakfast of cold meat pies. After cleaning up camp, they wouldn't garner any goodwill with the locals by leaving the Wodens full of refuse and fires, they made their way back to the alleged road, a dirt trail interrupted by rubbly patches where floods and mudslides had erased or buried the path ahead. It was slow going. On the steeper inclines, Dante found himself short of breath. He'd been spending too many days cooped inside the citadel, under Ollivander's tutelage. Tending to the administration of a newly independent Narashtivik was an important task, surely, but it had left him poorly equipped to deal with tasking climbs into mountainous hinterlands. The ridges were jagged basalt that looked as if they'd been sheared off within the last year, which they probably had. The snows in the Wodens were notoriously fierce, one of the many reasons so few people lived here. Even the Norren forswore them in favor of the southern hills and the less treacherous heights of the Dundons. He and Lou stopped some time before noon to rest their feet and eat more pies. Ever since entering the hills, Dante had tasked Lou with soothing the cuts, scrapes, and blisters they accrued while traveling. They shucked their shoes, and Lou frowned, holding his hands out before him as if warming them next to a fire. After a too long moment, shadows drifted to his hands, drawn from under stones and leaves, as sluggish as a stream in the plains. Lou frowned harder and ushered the nether to their feet. Dante's soles tickled. His blisters vanished. He wiggled his toes.
Nice work.
Thanks, Lou muttered. How much further to Sol, you think?
Couldn't say.
Have you seen any sign of it? The lights?
No, Dante said. Do you think we should turn back?
Of course not. Lou stiffened, face spreading with alarm. Unless you do. Then who would I be to insist we press on?
A person whose opinion might be worth listening to.
He reached for his boots. We'll go on. It isn't just lights. There were reports of sheep going missing.
Missing sheep, Lou said. And for that the council dispatches its highest priest?
Technically, that's still Ollivander. Anyway, we're here to do more than investigate. We owe the Easterners for their support during the war. This visit is part of our repayment.
Ah, politics.
Indeed. Dante stood and settled his pack on his shoulders. Politics. He climbed through switchbacks that overlooked sheer black cliffs. Pines clung tight to the pitched soil. It was early fall, but streamers of frigid mist wound through the trees, shredded by the rich green needles. At times the path plunged into stark valleys, desolate places that only saw daylight when the sun hung straight overhead. Dante saw no farms, no livestock, not even any trash, no evidence of human habitation besides the road itself. The sun tilted to the west. Dante descended into another valley. When they hiked up the far side, the sky grew no lighter. He made a face. It would be twilight soon. Still no sign of the village of Sol. He sighed, resolving to cross one more hill and call it a day. They ambled down a slope and up the other side. At the crest, Dante stopped and peered into the dimming light.
Well, Lou said, it's getting dark.
I see that. Dante pointed across the shallow valley. Past it, the land shot up in a swift cliff of black rock.
See that? The huge wall of impassable stone?
Wrong. The huge wall of stone that would be impassable if not for the staircase in it. Lou cocked his head. Dante strode forward before the young monk could object. As they grew close, Dante saw he'd been wrong about one thing. The cliffs weren't as steep as they appeared. Perhaps 45 degrees, and ascending beyond sight. The staircase was carved into its surface, tall steps that hardly had space for Dante's boots. The treads of the stairs were rounded and glossy in the middle, worn by centuries of footsteps. Lou looked even paler than normal.
You're thinking we should climb that?
Unless you're an especially talented jumper. Dante swayed up the steps. Sol should be right on the other side. He began a steady, upward pace. Between the angle and the coming night, it was hard to tell how high the staircase rose. He could see nothing beyond its far end. It seemed to stop in mid-air, as if the steps were a bridge to the stars that were beginning to peek from the deep blue skies. By unspoken mutual agreement, they halted halfway up to catch their breath. Dante looked back for the first time, which turned out to be an incredibly poor decision. 300 feet above the dark valley floor, it felt as if he were about to fall straight to his doom. He had to sit down and cling to the steps before they could attempt to shake him off. Lou looked away without a word. Dante felt strangely disappointed. He didn't pin down the emotion's source until he'd resumed climbing. A part of him had been wanting the kid to scoff at him, to joke that Dante had been bested by a set of steps. Instead, they climbed in stodgy silence. The only sound was the rush of their breath and the hiss of the wind and the pines to their sides. At last they neared the point where the steps conceded to the sky. Dante prayed it was the top, and that there wasn't another staircase beyond. Lou slowed, as if he were afraid the endless staircase might dump them into an equally bottomless ravine. The top landed them at the edge of a sprawling meadow. Grass rustled in the twilight, bordered by trees on all sides. 300 yards ahead, a village rested in the dregs of the day. Small, flickering lights pricked the face of the cliffs overlooking it. Dante trudged along the dirt path set in the knee-high grass. Despite the fires in the cliff and the village below it, he heard nothing besides the wind and a solitary pheasant clucking from the pines. He drew the nether close. In the village, a few dozen structures stood around a flagstone plaza. The buildings were hewn of mortared basalt, built to last. Each one was shuttered, vacant. A stone-lined stream trickled through the plaza's center, bridged at three places by arches built in the same fashion as the village. Dante turned in a circle, confirming Sol was empty, then tipped back his head at the cliffs. Candlelight flickered from a score of points in its face. He cupped his hands to his mouth. "Hello?" "Is this how it's supposed to look?" Lou whispered. "Perhaps they're afraid of the dark." "All of them?"
"Maybe they heard you were coming and fled to high ground to escape your complaints."
Dante cleared his throat.
"Hello?"
The call echoed off the rocks. 30 feet up, a shutter creaked open, spilling light into the darkness.
"What are you doing?" a man cried. "Trying to deduce why your village is vertical," Dante said. "Get out of here!"
"We've done nothing wrong. We're here on a mission of peace."
The man leaned far enough from his window to make out his silhouette.
"Then get out of this place while you still can!"
Lou tugged Dante's cloak, gazing into the forest.
"There's something out there."
"That's just the wind."
Dante turned back to the man in the high window.
"We've traveled all the way from Narashtovik, on foot no less, because you've chosen to make your home in a place where horses are too smart to travel."
The man hesitated.
"Narashtovik. I am a member of its highest council," Dante said.
Something rustled behind him. He blinked into the darkness.
"We're here to learn more about the lights. The death of your livestock."
"Look!"
Lou hissed, pointing. Dante followed his finger. Where the stream entered the plaza, a creature ruffled the grass. Dante's heart leapt.
"What the hell is that?"
Lou moaned.
"It's a capper."
Dante strained his eyes. In the dark grass, a silhouette slunk forward, man-sized at least, hunched over, four-legged. Primal alarm surged in Dante's chest. He whipped his head to face the cliffs, and something snapped at his nose. He shrieked, a small one, but undeniably a shriek, and batted at the object, which proved to be a knot-studded rope. It whopped against the cliff wall and swung back and forth.
"Hurry!"
the man called in a hoarse whisper. Lou gave Dante one look, then scrabbled up the rope. Across the plaza, the beast snorted. The rope jerked as Lou hauled himself up to the high window with surprising alacrity. A bass growl drifted from the stream. Dante jumped on the swaying rope and hauled himself up hand over hand, knees and elbows banging the cliff. He glanced toward the stream, but between the gloom and the twisting of the rope, he couldn't make out more than a shape lumbering into the square. Above, Lou's legs kicked and disappeared into the cliff. Dante reached the window, a stone ledge that opened into a warm room lit by a handful of tallow candles. Hands grabbed his wrists and hauled him inside. Lou's eyes were enormous. The man who'd thrown down the rope grabbed Dante's shoulders and looked him up and down. The man was late middle-aged, hands scabbed from hard work. His blunt, round nose resembled some of the smaller boulders they'd seen on their trek into the mountains.
"Are you all right?" he said.
"A little bruised from sprinting up a 30-foot wall," Dante said.
"Why the hell do you live in a cliff?"
The man tilted his head quizzically.
"Because of the cappers."
Lou leaned over the stone sill.
"Look!"
In the starlit plaza, a silhouetted beast lumbered across the grounds, pawing at stones. Dante frowned and focused the nether, shaping it into a simple point of white light. The man gasped and fell back a step, shoes scraping the stone floor. Dante winged the light down to the plaza, hovering at 10 feet above the ground, fairy-like. The beast swung its head toward the source of light and stood up on its hind paws to sniff the air.
"Would that be a black-furred capper," Dante said, "or the more common brown-haired variety?"
The bear, which was clearly a juvenile, snuffed loudly and dropped back to a four-footed posture. It pawed at a bit of trash wedged against one of the stone buildings. Dante raised his eyebrows at the middle-aged man.
"That's why you live in the cliffs, like a flock of pigeons?"
"That is obviously a harmless bear," the man sputtered. He moved to close the shutters.
"Cappers are another matter else entirely. The size of a bear, but armored, teeth like a shark, spiral horns like a unicorn, and harder to kill than a tick."
"You've seen one.
Do you really think we'd sleep 50 feet off the ground because of a superstition?"
"So you've structured your entire lives around them?" Dante gestured at the cave walls. "By day you go about your business on the ground, but as soon as night falls, it's up to the sky caverns."
"They haunt by night."
The man glanced about the room, as if just now realizing he'd hauled two strangers into his home, and it would be quite awkward to evict them after explaining why his entire village refused to set foot outside after dark.
"Can climb trees, too. How could you have been sent here without being told about the cappers?"
"We were told about them," Lou said. The man raised his graying brows at Dante.
"But you didn't believe."
"After that convincing display, you can be sure I do now." Dante stepped away from the shuttered window. "We're here to see a man named Astmodel. Does he live here?"
"Sure does."
"Can you show me to him?"
"Gods, no," the man said. "What kind of idiot climbs around on a cliff face in the middle of the night?"
Dante gathered himself to argue, then realized he was exhausted. The man's name was Vincent, and he offered to put Dante and Lou up in the smaller of his two rooms. Perhaps it was because of the complete darkness, or maybe just because they'd been hiking through the mountains for days on end, but Dante slept until Vincent flung open the shutters with a creak and a clap, exposing them to the morning. Attempting to be a good guest, Dante moved to the window to empty the chamber pot. Vincent grabbed his wrist, gaping in horror.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"Removing the piss from your house," Dante said. "Or were you saving it?"
"Not out the window, you're not. What if everyone did that? Think of the stink!"
He shook his head, tied a thin rope around the pot's handle, and gingerly lowered it foot by foot to the ground. Once it rested safely at the base of the cliffs, he pointed to a gap in the trees west of town.
"There's a rather large hole over yonder. I hope you can figure out how to use it."
Dante still hadn't had a sip of tea, but the climb down the knotted rope got his heart pumping fast enough to clear his head. He strolled across the plaza, holding the pot away from himself to avoid splashing. A couple dozen ropes dangled down the cliff like the world's biggest loom. People came and went from the stone buildings. Smoke rose from chimneys. The smell of baking bread, roast mutton, and fried greens filled the square. The odor above the yawning latrine was less wonderful. Dante emptied the pot, careful not to pitch himself into the pit along with it, walked to the stream to wash his hands, then returned to the plaza. There, Lou stood on tiptoes. He spotted Dante, and his eyes lit up.
"Breakfast, this way."
He led the way to one of the structures. Inside, a score of people poked at stovetop pans. Steam rose from the cooking. Vincent waved, grabbed a kettle, and brought them hot mugs of minty tea. It took Dante a minute to understand what he was seeing. The kitchens, and indeed much of the village, was communal. Privacy, and most private property, was reserved for the cliffside homes. Vincent finished at his station and brought them plates of bread, grits, fried mushrooms, wilted greens, and a few shreds of chicken. They ate outside. Though Dante didn't know what Astmodel looked like, he couldn't stop himself from glancing around the square.
"Ah," Vincent said, as they were busy scraping up the last of the grits with heels of bread. "There's your man."
Astmodel stood out from the others like an albino, or, in his case, the opposite. While Gascons were notoriously pale, Ast had a brush of color to his skin. Could easily pass for a citizen of far southern Bressel. Yet there was something else foreign to his features which Dante couldn't place.
"I wasn't sure you'd come,"
Ast said, making no effort to shake hands.
"It's just a few lights." "And got it cheap,"
Lou said, with a little too much enthusiasm.
"Whatever it is, it's unnatural," Dante said. "Narashtavik is happy to look into it and ensure no harm comes to your people."
Ast shrugged his thin shoulders.
"No one's being hurt. Strange things often appear in the mountains. In time, they disappear."
"I hear these signs have persisted for weeks. We'd rather be safe. Even if they're completely innocuous, a phenomenon like that is of interest to the council.
Getting them will require a wall tent. Are you aware of their use?"
"I'm not aware of their is," Dante said.
"Portable sleeping platforms," Ast said. "You secure them to the sides of the cliffs at night."
"Is that safe?" Lou said.
"Safer than sleeping on the ground."
"They won't be necessary," Dante said. Ast gave him a long look.
"You prefer to be shredded and devoured?"
"We won't need portable tents when I can create portable caves. All you need to do is provide a few supplies and lead the way."
The thin man looked skeptical, then nodded. "If that is your wish, the hike will take 3 days.
3 days? Dante said. "Where are we walking to, the moon?"
"This isn't Narashtovik. These are the Wodens. There are no roads."
"Well, that's ominous," Dante muttered. Ast went to gather the requisite food, clothes, and climbing gear, some of which he had stored in his cave, some of which he had to barter from other villagers. Compiling these goods took a couple hours, which Dante spent frustrated and bored. All he wanted to do was help these people, yet Ast, whom Ollivander swore by, he'd fought for Narashtavik during the Chainbreaker's War, seemed reticent to take a single step outside town.
Terrified of Kappas, no doubt.
Dante had seen their horns displayed as trophies, admittedly. At the same time, he'd lived in Gask for a decade, had traversed the lands from the Norrin Hills to Pocket Cove. In all that time, he'd never seen evidence of a live one. He decided to quit grousing about how much time they were losing and go save some instead. At a stone structure that housed 10 different vendors, he bought travel food. Meat pies, bread, smoked sausage, a few potatoes in case they got ambitious enough to cook on the trail. By the time he wrapped up, Ast returned with packs full of gear. They struck north at 10 that morning. A dirt trail switchbacked up the side of the cliff where Sol retired each night. At the top, the sun shined on a broad, windswept meadow, White sheep dotted the grass.
"Don't the Kappers eat the sheep?" Lou said.
"Sometimes," Ast said. "They seem to prefer humans."
"Curious," Dante said. "And convenient."
Ast gave him a sidelong look, but said no more.
Beyond the meadow, screes of dark shale footed sudden peaks. Ast led them over a spar of jumbled stones, which shifted threateningly underfoot, clacking dryly. In the sunlight, Dante worked up a hard sweat. The scree led up to another pine forest. Birds hopped from branch to branch, chided by squirrels. Slippery needles lay thick underfoot. Dante hunched his shoulder to wipe the sweat from the side of his face.
The woods continued for several forevers. It was a steady uphill slog, and very soon Dante was having serious thoughts about foregoing the whole endeavor to take up a life of farming, better yet, to become a fisherman, anywhere far from the mountains.
The sunlight grew brittle, the air chilly.
Ast nodded ahead. "Be on the lookout for cliffs. Anything 20 feet or higher should do."
Lou took his assignment very seriously, head on a swivel for any sign of rocky rises. Assuming they'd be rather easy to spot, Dante gave it no special attention. 20 minutes later, Ast pointed at a gap in the canopy. A black wall loomed above the forest. It was an everyday cliff, nearly vertical. Fist-sized rocks littered its base. Dante glanced at the sun, but it was hidden behind the trees. Maybe an hour until it set. Part of him wanted to continue on until dusk. There was no shortage of cliffs in the area. But another part of him, specifically his legs, argued for an immediate halt to all activity more rigorous than breathing. He got out his favorite knife, a short-bladed, antler-handled Norrin weapon that never went dull, and cut a quick line on the top of his left arm. As soon as he called to the nether, it flocked to the welling blood. He tilted back his head and felt for the nether woven into the rock of the cliff.
"You may want to stand back," he said.
The two men shuffled behind him, feet scraping over rocks. 25 feet up, Dante plunged his focus into the stone. He thought about dropping the excavation in a single dramatic boulder, but not wanting to make too much noise, or inadvertently smash Lou into monk jam, he opted to liquefy the rock into the consistency of thick mud. It flowed down the face of the cliff and settled over the sharded rock on the ground. Within moments, a hole large enough to climb through had appeared in the side of the wall.
"Not bad," Ast said. "It isn't."
Dante took a step back to examine the cliff.
"But here's the best part."
Starting just below the cave, he gouged a small hole in the rock, leaving a lip of stone on its bottom edge. A foot below that, he duplicated it, continuing in this fashion all the way down the cliff. He'd soon carved a makeshift ladder up the wall.
He staggered back, legs trembling.
He could move much more earth than that, but delicate work was always more draining. "Should be a little easier than a rope."
This time, Ast's look was unreadable.
"I'd heard about your people. I saw some of you during the war, but I never knew you were capable of a thing like this."
"The others aren't," Dante said, allowing a certain pride to enter his voice. "Just me."
Ast nodded vaguely.
"Hungry?"
"As a capper."
Lou laughed uncertainly. They sat down on a fallen log. At the other end, wear and insects had reduced the wood to a spongy crumble. Inch-long black ants trundled through the orange bits. Dante kept one eye on them as he ate his meat pie.
"Tell me more about these signs," he said.
Ast gave it some thought.
"Lights in the sky. They are rumored to resemble ghost lights."
"Isn't it too early in the year for that?"
"I don't have a direct line to the clouds,"
Ast said. But through careful observation, I've discovered they do whatever they want whenever they want. If it were to snow tomorrow, you might think it's too early in the season, but you couldn't argue with the fact there was snow.
He probably could,
Lou said, then shot a startled look at Dante. Dante ignored this.
Sure, but if the snowflakes were shaped like trees, or cicadas, I might begin to suspect it wasn't your average everyday storm.
Ast chewed bread, watching the woods, and brushed crumbs from his shirt.
People see shapes that aren't there,
particularly people who spend all day staring at sheep. In a couple of days, you can see for yourself. They finished eating and climbed the makeshift ladder to the cave. Inside, they spread blankets on the smooth floor and hung sheepskins over the small entrance to help trap their body heat inside.
Even so, the cold woke Dante more than once. When it did, he pulled aside the sheepskin and watched the night, but saw no strange lights in the sky.
At daybreak, they climbed down and prepared for the day's hike. Dante didn't bother to fill in the cave. They'd need it on the way back. And in any event, he wanted to conserve his strength. The forest quit abruptly just an hour into the day, spitting them into a craggy field bereft of everything but shrubs, weeds, a few late-season wildflowers, and a hell of a lot of boulders. They stopped at the edge of the pines to cut walking staffs, then continued into the rocks. The uneven footing made for slow going. Ahead, conical peaks soared against the sky, white-capped and forbidding. Lou struggled to keep up. Their breath misted the air. Patches of snow hid in sheltered blue pockets the sun rarely touched. The fields stretched for a few miles that took far too long to cross. Elevated above all but the highest peaks, and with no ground cover taller than his waist, Dante felt simultaneously exposed and protected. It would be virtually impossible to sneak up on them here. Shortly after noon, they climbed a short ridge and found themselves at the edge of a sheer ravine. The gap plunged 100 feet to a frozen streambed of bright ice. The far edge of the ravine hung 60 feet away.
"Shall we climb down?" Ast said. "Or would you prefer to save us an hour and simply sling a rock bridge across it?"
"A bridge?" Dante said. "I must have left it in my other cloak."
"Yesterday, I watched you carve a hole in a cliff by staring at it. Would this be so much harder?"
"Yes, and significantly more prone to collapsing halfway across and dashing our brains against a glacier. I could probably conjure up a sturdy enough bridge, but that might leave me too worn out to create a cave tonight. And where does that leave us? In a Kappa's stomach."
"And we didn't bring a wall tent." Ast nodded. "Let's hope we've got enough rope."
They'd need every bit of it to descend the ravine, which had a few ledges here and there, but was otherwise vertical. Ast secured the rope around a rock, then belted himself to the rope, gave it a tug, slipped on thin leather gloves, and started down.
"Just like that, then," Dante said.
5 feet down the cliff face, Ast glanced up, squinting against the sun directly overhead.
"Well, unless you'd prefer to jump."
"Lou first. I can use him to cushion my fall." Dante looped his belt over the rope and got on gloves. Once Ast was halfway down, he paused on a ledge and signaled Dante to follow. With his pack and clothes, the going was awkward. The first time his feet dangled into empty space, he had to bite down a scream. Yet the climb wasn't as atrocious as he expected. With his legs curled around the rope, his belt threaded around it, and the cliff right beside him, much of the pressure was eased from his arms. And he was able to take breathers on 3 separate ledges. He did his best not to look down, until Ast finally called from below. He'd reached the bottom. Dante looked up and gestured Lou to follow.
A couple of minutes later, his feet scraped solid ground. He lowered himself and removed his belt from the rope. Pebbles and dust skittered down the cliff, dislodged by Lou's scrabbling. While Dante waited for the young monk, Ast crunched across the ribbon of ice and gazed up at another cliff. Lou lowered himself inch by inch. 6 feet from the ground, he let go, rope sliding between his belt and legs. He jarred into the ground and crouched.
They do not teach us this in the monastery.
I'll take it up with your master. Dante tipped back his head. Go make yourself useful to Ast. Lou scurried across the rocks, slowing to pick his way across the ice. Absently, Dante opened a small cut on his arm, gazed at the spot where the rope disappeared over the top of the cliff, and felt his way through the nether to the rock where the rope was secured. With the thought, he turned the rock's base as soft as sand, then yanked on the rope with all his weight. It caught, then jerked free. Dante sat down hard. He scrabbled out of the way as the rope thumped to the ground in loose coils. He gathered it up and carried it across the ice to Ast, who had hammered a couple of spikes into the side of the opposite cliff. Ast glanced over his shoulder, noted the rope. That should make things easier. Dante threw the coils at his feet. How were we going to get up without it?
With great difficulty.
Ast had already shed his cloak and all the gear except two small but heavy pouches. He spent the next half hour scaling the cliff freehand, securing the rope to ledges, outcrops, and spikes bashed into nooks in the rock. Dante watched the skies. Supposedly the lights only appeared at night, but maybe that was because no one thought to look during the day. At last, Ast reached the top, then clambered back down, stopping at a ledge some 30 feet high.
This is the only tricky part. Cliff slopes in here. Bring up the gear, then I'll give you a hand up.
Dante loaded up and did as he was told, hauling himself up the rope. Dust clung to his gloves and sweaty face. The air smelled of ice and freshly broken rock. He climbed the first 20 feet quite easily, but as he grew nearer to the ledge where Ast was perched, the cliff slanted away from him, separating him from its face. He paused a moment to catch his breath, then hauled himself up to the lip of rock. A hand poked from the edge. Dante wrapped his arm around the rope, unshouldered a pack, and passed it up. Once he transferred the last of the gear to Ast, he grabbed the ledge to pull himself up. Grit slid under his gloved hand. He felt his grip give, first on his left hand, then his right. He kicked at the rope to try to tangle his legs and realized he'd forgotten to belt himself to it. The ground spun 30 feet beneath him. With a shout, he fell into empty space. Ast grabbed his wrist, pitching forward. Dante dangled, pawing for the rope, but he'd fallen to the side and couldn't make contact. Tendons bulged on Ast's neck. Inch by inch, he slid across the dusty platform. Dante took a quick breath and dived into the nether in the cliff. Ast scraped over the black rock, grunting. With his free hand, he grabbed up the rope. Dante's weight pulled him from the ledge. For a moment, he hung onto the rope. Dante suspended beneath him, and then his hold gave out. Lou shouted. They fell. A black platform shot from the rock 2 feet below them. Dante landed on it, and then Ast landed on him, bashing the breath from his lungs. Dante fought for air, sprawled on his back, and laughed stupidly.
Nice catch, Ast said dryly.
Could say the same for you, Dante managed. Thank you.
It was nothing. But please don't do it again. Not unless you're able to reattach yanked-free arms.
I've never tried.
Dante sat up and brushed himself off. He was scraped and bruised, but intact. He leaned over the edge and called down.
Bad news, Lou. You still have to climb this after all.
They made it up without further incident.
stopping above the ravine to let their hearts settle and to knock off the dust. All told, the crossing had cost them 2 hours. 2 hours to travel 60 horizontal feet. Dante really needed to learn how to fly. They spent the next couple hours crossing a flat, gleaming snowfield, interrupted by fingers of ebony rock. Dante's boots soaked straight through. He was starting to think this trip had been a mistake. There might be a few gutted sheep out here in the wilds, but whatever was happening was too far removed to menace Sol or the other villagers in the foothills. After a long, steady descent, another pine forest swallowed them up. They called an early day to build a fire and dry their shoes as best they could. Ast scouted another cliff, into which Dante hollowed another cave. They returned to the fire to warm up dinner. The smoke smelled good. So did the meat pies heated in the pan. Oil, fried dough, warm shredded pork. "Of all the ways I've almost ever died," Dante said between bites, "I think that's the first time it's been from falling off a cliff." Ast chuckled. "It wouldn't be the first to be claimed by the Wodans." "Are you from here?" Lou said brightly. "More or less." "How can a place be more or less your birthplace?"
"I was born here," Ast said carefully. "But we don't consider it our homeland."
"We," Dante said.
Ast gestured to take in the woods and mountains. "My people."
Lou dunked a chunk of bread in melted snow water, softening it. "If you miss it so bad, why don't you just go home?" The man laughed. "It turns out it's difficult to go back to a place that no longer exists."
"Oh!"
Lou cleared his throat, blushing.
"What happened, if you don't mind my asking?"
"War," Ast shrugged. "That's all."
They stayed by the fire through dusk, warming themselves, steam rising from their boots. The sun glowed orange on the peaks, then stole away behind the western ridges. They climbed up to the cave and settled in for another cold night. Hours later, light flashed on Dante's eyelids. He felt far too tired for it to be dawn already. He parted the sheepskins on the cave's entrance and stared into the frozen night. Starlight played on frosted pine needles. So did other colors. Pinks, pastel blues, electric greens. He leaned out from the cave and craned his neck, but the lights were sourced on the other side of the cliff, out of sight. But he could see plenty. Narashtovic was far enough north that he'd witnessed the ghost lights on 3 different occasions, and the colors in the sky did not resemble the ghost lights. The 3 of them had borne their swords with them all this way. Dante retreated into the cave to fetch his blade and his boots. Once he'd put these on, he poured out past the sheepskins, found his torchstone, and blew on it, illuminating himself in soft, white light. More than enough to find his way down the ladder, hewn into the stone. He reached the ground and backed away from the cliffs. His breath hung heavy in the air. The torchstone glowed on gnarled pines and spotty grasses. He walked briskly through the undergrowth, climbed a small rise, and emerged onto a bald crown of rock. Behind the cliffs, rainbows of fluid light flowed across the skies. Sometimes they weren't so different from the ghost lights of winter, eerie reds, greens, and blues flickering rhythmically, as if to a silent tune. But at other times they formed abstract lines and shapes. Once he could have sworn he saw a winged insect, another time a rabbit. An ethermancer could create such illusions, but unless the fellow was insane, this would be a very strange place to be doing so. Twigs snapped behind him. He turned, turning the torchstone with him. Eyes flashed from the darkness. Horns. teeth and plated scales worn by a beast the size of a bear. The kappa lowered its head and charged.
Chapter 2 Lord Pendulous awoke in a stranger's sheets, sweaty, hungover, and eminently pleased with himself. He stretched, wincing lightly at the headache behind his right temple. It was indeed a hard life, being chauffeured around the countryside to drink the fine wines and liquors of Gask's wealthiest men, but someone had to keep these fools entertained. He kicked the sheets off his legs to cool down while he attempted to remember the precise course of the previous night's wine-soaked conversation. Not that he particularly cared what Duke Dillinger had to say about much of anything. Besides, perhaps, here is your wagon train of silver. But Pendulous was here on business, and as he had learned, there was a very particular art to business— or anyway, to the business that involved lords, ladies, and those few commoners rich enough to buy such titles. While a few of these people of means were no-nonsense types who preferred to throw out proposals and hammer down details before you had the chance to sit down, most were far more leisurely about it. Perhaps because while commerce was the chief occupation of merchants and the like, the chief occupation of the upper crust was, in fact, leisure. Such as stretching your legs and curling your toes beneath silk sheets that someone else would have to wash. So, he relived the conversation, or anyway the parts he could remember, and soon determined he'd made no major gaffes. Had been quite content to pass the night exchanging rude jokes and court gossip. For Duke Dillinger was the nephew of King Modigan himself, and was young enough to believe the crown would some day leave lines across his own scalp. There had been no mention of business at all until nearly the end of what Pendulous could recall. Dillinger had brought it up, promising breezily they'd get down to the wheels of the thing on the morrow, meaning what was now today. At last, Pendulous would have his answers. With this settled in his mind, he pulled the lever tied to the string attached to the bells in the kitchen. A servant arrived in seconds. Pendulous requested a mixture of rum, tea, and spices he'd discovered years ago, which served as an admirably potent waker-upper hangover cure. The servant returned with the drink and a spread of cheeses. Pendulous accepted these, dressed in nothing but his sheet, then took them to the balcony, letting the sheet fall from him as he walked. Outside, he sat, carefully, on a lacquered chair, sipped his rum, and contemplated the pastoral grounds. After an hour, nothing had come his way that was more exciting than a cool breeze, so he went inside, dressed, a procedure that took a quarter of an hour, and was perhaps the single most galling element of this life, and went downstairs to let his presence announce that the day, and its events, could now be introduced to him. In the sitting room, the majordomo informed him that the Duke was still attending to his rest, but was expected to be down shortly. The man sent another servant around to bring Pendulous a proper breakfast of eggs, cream, blueberries, roasted hen, and more tea, which he consumed in the sitting room, overlooking the pines dotting the lawn. This, too, was quite nice. There was no denying it. Yet Pendulous was struck sometimes by the colossal waste all this downtime represented. This hadn't always been his life. Once he'd been a roamer. He'd been known to get into a fight or two. At times like these, enfolded in a chair so plush it was like being hugged, he knew what he was doing was highly important, perhaps the most important thing he'd done in his life, yet that wasn't easy to remember when you were wiping cream from your mouth a few minutes before noon, and you had yet to see the day's first hint of the man you were supposed to be conducing crucial business with. Enough whining. He would make his proposal today. Whether the Duke said yes or no, Pendulous would be free to move forward. Dillinger showed up, dressed and fed, at 1 o'clock.
His dark hair was wavy in the way of so much Gascon royalty. He wore a simple blue doublet with white piping, and a heavy-lidded smile that suggested he'd started the day with the same bottle he'd ended the night.
"Lord Pendulous," he said scratchily, "how's your morning?"